Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Here and Now. Well, the sun is finally coming out in the nation's capital after a week of intense weather, but another political storm is brewing. The day after a landmark Supreme Court ruling, Republicans in Congress plan to write legislation that would allow President Bush to use military tribunals to try Guantanamo Bay detainees. According to the Los Angeles Times, the ruling is prompting the Pentagon to rethink how it handles all interrogations. But how much in Washington is really changing? And why is the president going to Graceland today? For the answers to those and other questions, we turn to John Harwood. He's chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome, John.
Great to be here.
As far as you can tell, do you think Congress will help the president essentially duplicate the military tribunals that the Supreme Court struck down yesterday?
I think it's likely that they will. Republicans certainly seized immediately on the prospect that they could again continue the shift in the discussion toward the war on terror from the other things Washington's been preoccupied with. They'll try to give the president the authority he seeks, and they're willing to take their chances as to whether Democrats are willing to stand up against it. Their guess is that Democrats will cooperate and that this authority will pass.
Any long-term political damage from yesterday's ruling?
Well, you know, it's one of those cases where the president had a substantive setback. It harmed him internationally. It was a rebuke at the expansive view of executive authority that he has favored. Politically, it could end up being a gift for the White House because it allows the president to say, I'm trying to fight the war on terror, but the judiciary is stopping me, and again, extend the discussion of the methods by which the administration is attempting to crack down on terrorists overseas in Guantanamo and elsewhere.
In your column in the Wall Street Journal today, you write about some July 4th recess kits for Republicans. I guess they're talking points for those campaigning in their home districts this weekend. What did the kits say about immigration?
Well, House Republicans are attempting to really pound away over the next several weeks at the Senate bill, which they view as an amnesty bill that's weak on border security. It's not yet clear whether or not what Republicans are doing is going to clear the way and provide political cover for an eventual deal or kill a deal. But right now, Republicans are taking the tack that they know works for them politically.
Let's talk about some newsworthy media matters. President Bush had some harsh words for the New York Times after last week's story about the surveillance of banking records. But, you know, the Wall Street Journal had the same story, right, from the same Treasury officials, and the Journal's editorial page is defending its coverage. What do you make of this controversy?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, the editorial makes the argument that the New York Times was pushing to publish the story over the objections of the administration, and that we at the Wall Street Journal were simply publishing something that we were briefed on and not asked to withhold. The reason why the New York Times is front and center in the attacks from the administration and Republicans on the Hill is that it is regarded as a symbol of what they argue is the liberal media, and they love the idea in one stroke, beat up on the liberal media and also promote the efforts the administration is making in the war on terror. That's why Republicans took it up on the floor of the House yesterday, and they certainly want to talk about it more than issues like immigration and the estate tax and things that are dividing their party at the moment.
Right. USA Today had a story acknowledging that there were some gaps in this story about the national surveillance effort of phone records. The paper first reported last month about the program, and it now says it can't verify that Bell South and Verizon did have contracts with the National Security Agency to secretly monitor phone records. The paper does say, stands by its reporting, but how much do you think will be made of this, John?
Well, again, I think it does play into the discussion that Republicans are enjoying at the moment about, you know, what does the media get wrong? Is their judgment really right? Whose side are they on? And remember, a surveillance of phone records is where the administration began this fairly aggressive discussion at odds with the New York Times when they disclosed the program a few months ago.
Right. And, John, we have this final note.
Hold me close, hold me tight, make me sleep with the light. I want you, I need you, I love you with all my heart.
Well, that's Japan's Prime Minister Koizumi singing Elvis. He and President Bush are visiting Graceland today, and they keep singing this song to each other. What do you make of this?
Two hound dogs on the road. They're very close friends. Koizumi, of course, shares a birthday with Elvis Presley. He's been a lifelong fan. And as he prepares to leave office, his friend President Bush, who appreciates the Japanese government's support in the war on terror, decided to salute him by taking him to Graceland and hang out with Elvis's widow and daughter. It was a moment of pure fun, obviously, for Koizumi and Bush as well.
That's John Harwood, Chief Washington Correspondent for CNBC and National Political Editor for The Wall Street Journal, joining us from Washington. Thanks very much. Mexicans head to the polls Sunday to vote for a new president. 6 years into the presidency of Vicente Fox, who by law cannot seek re-election, Mexicans are united in the need for change, but deeply divided over what that change should look like. We're joined by two guests from Mexico City, Houston Chronicle reporter Dudley Althaus, and Chapel Lawson, an associate professor of political science at MIT and an official election observer. And Dudley, let's start with you. There are three candidates considered serious in the presidential election and two frontrunners here, former Mexico City Mayor Andre Manuel López Obrador, who's known as AMLO, and Fox's former Energy Secretary Felipe Calderón. Can you tell us about them?
The front runner in most polls right now is Andres Manuel López Obrador, who is the former mayor of Mexico City. He's left-leaning. He's running against Felipe Calderón, who's from Fox's center-right National Action Party. Calderón can be expected to continue many of Fox's economic policies. It may shift a little bit on social policy, but not much. And thirdly is Roberto Madrazo of the Institutional Revolutionary Party, which governed Mexico for most of the 20th century. He's running in third place in most polls.
Chapo, what's the big issue here?
Now, I think the big issue is really different depending on who you ask. If you ask somebody in the political class, the heads of one of the parties, the National Action Party or the left, someone in business or one of the leaders of the social movements, you really see an ideological divide, a choice about which way Mexico will go. Will it retain free market economic policies, or will it move back to some form of leftist populism under AMLO, as Andrés Manuel López Obrador is known? If you ask the person on the street, I don't think those issues are really at the top of their mind. I think the typical voter is thinking more in terms of candidate traits. So which of these two men is more honest, more empathetic to their concerns, more competent in administering the economy and the government more broadly.
Yeah, Dudley, you've called this a NAFTA election. Would you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, I see this as sort of a NAFTA election. I think the elections of the 1990s were more about whether the PRI or the ruling party stayed or went. I think people are much more focused on whether they have benefited from the economic opening of the past 15 years or whether they haven't.
Let me just jump in here.
Mexico's
economy is a little bit like a plane running on one engine. Over the last 20 years, the export sector has done quite well, but the domestic economy hasn't done well enough. So a plane running on one engine can stay in the air. It's not going to crash, but at the same time, it can't really gain any altitude. And I think people are very sensitive to that.
We here, obviously, are embroiled in this debate about immigration. How much of it is an issue in Mexico, Dudley?
I think all the candidates have agreed that the problem is here in Mexico, and it's an economic problem. It's a jobs creation problem. So then the debate is basically about how each of them would solve the poverty issues in Mexico.
Chapo, let's talk about the voting process itself. How are the campaigns run by these candidates?
Mexico used to have a famously dirty electoral system with a healthy dose of fraud and a lot of vote buying. But the change over the last 10 years has just been remarkable. Mexico now has a fourth branch of government, essentially, the Federal Electoral Institute, that oversees all federal elections. All votes in the presidential election are worth the same, so there's no electoral college. After so many years of electoral fraud and vote buying and manipulation of social programs, not everybody trusts the new electoral system. But from an outsider's perspective, it looks very good. There is a new trend in Mexican politics, which is not entirely welcome and to some extent has been imported from the United States, and that's very vicious negative advertising on television. Over the last 3 or 4 months, the PAN and people in the business community have been attempting to paint AMLO as a dangerous demagogue, as a, as they put it, quote, a danger to Mexico. And they run a relentless series of ads comparing him to Hugo Chavez. AMLO has, and his party, the Party of the Democratic Revolution, have responded in kind and accused Felipe Calderon of corruption or influence peddling through his brother-in-law. And most of the campaign over the last couple months has revolved around these sorts of charges.
So can we say from this, do you think, Dudley, get an accurate gauge at all about how voters might be feeling going into the polls? Are people excited about this election, or how would you describe it?
I don't think there's a groundswell of excitement. I think you don't feel the excitement, say, of 2000 or of 1988 or 1994. There's not that kind of excitement of sort of like this country's going to change dramatically. A lot of the people who fought for democracy for a long time are very disenchanted with the situation this year. They feel that the political process is in the control only of the political parties. The society has been disconnected.
You know, if I could just jump in on that last point, too. I went to the closing rally of the AMLO campaign, the Zocalo, which is downtown Mexico City, and it did not feel like a revolution in the making. I don't think one ignites a revolution by promising macroeconomic stability, as AMLO did in his closing speech. It really felt much more like a broad-based, eclectic political movement without the fire of previous elections. In terms of the effects of the election on the United States, it's hard to see any of the fundamental elements of the relationship being questioned or undermined by the outcome of the election, that I don't think any of these candidates is going to repudiate NAFTA. Felipe Calderon would be very easy for Americans to understand. He speaks English. He has a master's degree from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Almost a little bit of a question mark. He's traditionally shown little interest in foreign policy. That said, his speeches aren't laced with the anti-American rhetoric that has sometimes characterized leftist discourse here in the past.
So how do you think AMLO's chances are?
I've gotten a sense in the last couple days that the momentum is in favor of AMLO, that the official campaign period is over, so there are no campaign rallies. So this is meant to be a period of reflection right before Mexicans go to the polls on Sunday.
Dudley, do you agree with that?
I think AMLO's definitely the guy to beat. I also think that at the end, Mexico might prove more conservative than many think. So things can change rather radically. People don't answer the polls like they should. And I would agree with the professor that we've parsed these poll numbers as much as we can, these opinion poll numbers. And it's really just going to be, you know, we'll know Sunday night or Monday, I suppose.
All right. Well, thanks to both of you for speaking with us. Dudley Althaus, Houston Chronicle reporter, thank you very much.
Sure.
And Chapel Lawson is an associate professor of political science at MIT, who's an official election observer. Thank you, Chapel.
My pleasure.
Still to come, a longtime foster mother and writer says foster parents are professionals skilled in dealing with troubled children, and they should be able to unionize. There's more coming up here and now. May be a first in the nation, foster parents in Washington State are looking to unionize. They say a union would mean higher professional standards, better compensation, and less turnover among the people taking care of neglected and abused children. Author Kathy Harrison knows a few things about foster parenting. Over the past 16 years, she and her husband Bruce have taken care of more than 100 children in their Massachusetts home. Her most recent book is One Small Boat, The Story of a Little Girl Lost, Then Found. And Kathy Harrison joins us on the line. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You were recently named a spokesperson for the National Foster Parent Association. Has that association taken a position at all on this unionization effort in Washington State?
They have not yet taken an official position on the matter. They're certainly interested, and in fact, they are intrigued.
Mm. What do you think, though, as a foster parent?
My personal opinion. We have a real problem in this country with the recruitment and the retention of quality homes. Part of the problem comes from the perception of who foster parents are. and the result of a lack of respect for the role we play in the lives of really vulnerable and traumatized kids.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if a union could be used as a tool, and I could see it being a good tool to strengthen training standards, to provide the kind of financial support and benefit program that any other professional receives, then I would certainly be in favor of such an organization. You know, we are a country that shows how we respect people often with a paycheck. And I don't think about this organization as benefiting me primarily in a financial way. I certainly see it ultimately benefiting children.
You know, there's been some criticism, though, which makes me just want to ask you about this for a second. One state representative in Washington who has also been a foster parent rejects this whole idea and says people who are opening their home to children that need parental role models are volunteers, and this is not employment. And you know, maybe there's a point there, though. Is there something in this line of work where you're parenting, really? Is there something unseemly about the money aspect of it that then makes it at least appear as if the child is not your primary obligation?
It's so interesting when I hear people talk like that. There are certain professions that we consider callings. You know, the ministry, usually the healing professions, educators, teachers. You are driven to do this kind of work. However, all of those people get paid. And I know that when I go to the grocery store, I can hand them a cup of good intentions. You would be surprised at how reluctant they are to accept it. Taking care of children is not something that one can do on a total shoestring. I spend more than I make most of the time. So there is that piece about being reimbursed for the amount of money we spend, but there's the other piece, and this is what I think matters. This is about respect for the work we do. My children are seriously, viciously traumatized kids often. I feel like my goal is to have children move from my home into a permanent, stable, loving family, whether it is their own or an adoptive placement, and ultimately become a productive member of society. I do not see my role as warehousing them until they hit the criminal justice system, which is what happens when you get the notion that this is just, you know, you're providing a good role model, you pay your bills and take your kids to church. There is a lot more to it than that.
How much do foster parents get paid right now per child?
We're on a tier so that I think our smallest children, perhaps the reimbursement rate is $17 a day, and I believe it goes up to just under $20 for a teenager.
And in your book that you've just written, In One Small Boat, you talk about the story of Daisy, who had significant problems. And I think that's probably an example of what you're talking about here in terms of having the ability to be able to take care of some of those issues. Can you just describe Daisy's case a bit for us?
I can. She had been sexually abused from the time she was quite small and cared for by a mother with some mental health issues. She came to me anorexic, could not swallow food. I spent weeks and weeks feeding her through a straw, literally taking drops of juice and putting it on her tongue to get her to swallow. She'd been in and out of psychiatric hospitals, had a bag full of medication. We spent the better part of a year, maybe a year and a half, with this little girl and really made some changes. This was a child who put on almost 10 pounds over the course of 18 months, who began to do well in school, who was able to process her losses and move in with her birth father and make a good connection. Could I have done it if I'd been in work full time so that I had health insurance benefits? Absolutely not.
Right.
And when you talk about $17 a day, in this country, we pay more to board a dog who gets a kennel and two cups of food a day than we are willing to pay happily to board a child who needs the kind of care my children need. You know, you hear all of this family value. Well, for goodness sakes, then value us. We are a family, and we are a family that deserves, if anything, more recognition because we are a family that we create out of genuinely caring about kids. But, you know, part of the problem comes people read the headlines in the newspaper and they say, oh, but look at what they did. They, you know, duct taped this kid and didn't feed him and he weighed 60 pounds at 18. Those horror stories happen. But here is the reality. There are 550,000 children in the foster care system. Every day, the majority of foster parents get up, put their feet on the floor, and do this really hard work.
When we go back to this story about Daisy, and you mentioned that she eventually went to go live with her biological father, I'm wondering, when you spend all that time feeding a child through a straw and doing all that work, how is it possible to stay detached enough to give that child back to a biological parent or another family?
Did someone tell you I stayed detached? They're not telling the truth. I don't know who told you that. Here's the reality. There are times when my heart is broken, and I mean I can feel it ripping in my chest. But I am a grown-up, and I'm well put together, and I can do that because that's who I am. This kid is a child. She cannot afford ever. No child can afford to be raised by anybody whose face does not light up when they walk into a room. You have to be willing to do the work, to attach, to learn how to say goodbye, because this is not about the adults. This is about what this kid needs.
Kathy, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kathy Harrison is a foster mom and author of the book One Small Boat, The Story of a Little Girl Lost, Then Found. Next week on Here and Now, we start the week with some U.S. history, the Pilgrims, according to Nathaniel Philbrick, plus Beyond the Backyard Barbecue, a look at what are now known as outdoor kitchens. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, 40 years of violence could be coming to an end in Spain. The government this week announced plans to open peace talks with the Basque separatist group known as ETA, which called a permanent ceasefire in March after decades of bombings and assassinations. As part of the talks, the northern Basque region will likely seek greater autonomy from Madrid. Some critics say that could be the beginning of the end for Spain, as other Spanish regions also seek more independence. John Peet is Europe editor for The Economist magazine in London. And John, several Spanish leaders have tried but failed to make peace with ETA before. Do you think it looks more promising for Prime Minister Zapatero?
I think it definitely looks more promising now. The biggest problem over the Basque country, as you say, is that ETA chose to wage a guerrilla war and have killed a lot of people over the last 30 years. But I think two things have come together to mean that the situation looks more hopeful now. The first is the willingness of Zapatero and his government to negotiate on more autonomy, both for Catalonia and the Basque country. And I think many Basques who want more self-government are willing to go down that road rather than continue to fight for a sort of independent state. And the other thing was, of course, the train bombings that happened in March 2004, which were the work of Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda associates. And because of that, it's made it much harder for ETA to continue down the route of violence, which Spaniards, obviously most Spaniards and most Basques, reject. So in a sense, they were driven towards the logic of negotiating instead.
I read that there were rallies in Spain, though, also against this proposal to open peace talks.
The center-right People's Party believe that you shouldn't talk to ETA, you should defeat ETA. And there are many Spaniards, particularly those who've had relatives killed over the years, who still take that view. I think most people that I talk to believe that it's better to follow the British example, where although many people in Northern Ireland think talking to the IRA was a very bad thing, the goal of peace and ultimately some kind of settlement for the province was worth going for, even if it meant seeming to talk to men who had a violent past. Nobody's suggesting that ETA prisoners should be released or anything like that, but I think most Spaniards do feel that it is worth going down the route of negotiation if it's going to bring an end to a 40-year-old conflict.
What do you think the Basque separatists would hope to get from a peace deal?
Basque country has a lot of autonomous powers. They want even more powers. They want to have some implicit or explicit recognition of their national rights, their linguistic rights. Clearly, some people in ETA would like it to go further and end up in some kind of independence. I think, as of now, a majority of Basques do not see the need for independence and would be happy with something that is a highly autonomous situation, rather akin to Quebec in Canada. The argument about independence will not completely go away, but at the moment I don't think that that's the route that majority of Basques want to take.
Remind us again, for those folks who may not know, how did this whole conflict, this 38 years of conflict with ETA start? What is ETA's main goal here?
Well, ETA would like to set up a separate Basque country, which would include the three Basque provinces in Spain and indeed a part of France, which is the ancient Basque country. That is their explicit goal, rather as the IRA in Ireland has an explicit goal of uniting the two parts of Ireland. But a majority of people in the Basque country, like a majority of people in Northern Ireland, don't want to go down that road. So they are clearly going to have to settle for something short of that. The reason the conflict really began was because in Franco's years, the Spanish government was very repressive. And I think that's what gave birth to the ETA movement. It's just taken a long time for a democratic Spanish government to get round to negotiating in such a way as to eliminate that threat.
So do you think it makes it difficult for some people in Spain to come to terms with a peace deal with ETA because the group is responsible for more than 800 deaths?
It does indeed. And it is always a very difficult situation. I mean, there are so many examples all around Europe, to say nothing of Israel-Palestine, where the move from being an armed group that indulges in terrorism towards participating in a political process that then leads to some kind of political settlement is an extremely fraught one, which generates resistance on both sides and will require quite careful political maneuvering by the government and indeed by the opposition.
Well, the Basque region's bid for more autonomy could be boosted by a recent referendum in Catalonia, which many people might know is where the city of Barcelona is. The people in Catalonia voted for more autonomy from the central government. Can you tell us about that vote?
Well, yes, there have been negotiations going on for some time under the socialist government of Zapatero. The Catalans have been demanding more autonomy for many years. They feel they wanted to be recognized as a separate nation. They wanted more control over their taxes. And he chose to have a negotiation with them about revising the constitution. And it was that revision, opposed by many people in Madrid, that was then put to the vote in Catalonia and passed recently. That's going to be now their constitution. It gives them much more power. It doesn't give them independence, but there are some Catalans who would still like to go all the way for independence. But a majority seem to be satisfied with considerable autonomy and some kind of acknowledgement that they have a very long history as a separate nation.
Mm-hmm. But it stops short of actually saying that they're a separate nation.
That's correct.
Some people have said that the other 16 autonomous regions in Spain may try to follow this referendum and do a similar thing. What do you think?
Well, I think that is possible. I mean, Spain is not unique in Europe in having regions that wish to press for more autonomy and regions that feel that they want sort of some kind of recognition of their powers and even sometimes aspire to some kind of nationhood. But it's probably stronger in Spain, the regional feeling. And one of the problems that was inherited after the Franco period was indeed that if you give Catalonia and the Basque country some kind of separate status and give them more autonomy, the other regions will say, why can't we have it too? And Galicia is clearly going down that road already. There is a risk in that, and opponents of this change argue that it could ultimately lead to the unraveling of Spain. I think that's very exaggerated, but there is that argument.
We should also mention, though, in terms of the Catalan referendum, that the turnout wasn't all that high.
Opponents of the measure will say, look, you know, they chose to stay on the beaches rather than vote. Most people I've spoken to say that the reason the turnout was low was because everybody assumed it would be passed. Not many people were opposed to it. The People's Party, the centre-right opposition in Madrid, were against, but they're weak in Barcelona. All the mainstream parties in Catalonia were strongly in favour of this.
John, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Okay.
John Peet is Europe editor for The Economist magazine. He spoke with us from London. Still to come, are there more bicycles on the road during rush hour? Could it have something to do with the price of gas? Or maybe it's that some cities are trying to become more bike-friendly. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, with school now out, for many kids, this is the time of year for summer camp. Rather than the traditional cabin in the woods, many camps are specialized. There are sports camps, computer camps, arts camps, and in Michigan, a program for teenagers to help them learn how to become political activists for gay rights. Joining us is Greg Varnum. He's the camp director and the youth initiatives coordinator for the Triangle Foundation, which works with Michigan's gay, lesbian, transgender, and allied communities, and has organized the week-long summer program known as Camping Out. Greg, welcome.
Thank you.
Is this a camp that's only for gay campers or for those who may be uncertain about their sexual orientation?
It's actually for any youth who are interested in gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender issues. So that might be allies of GLBT youth, or it might be children in GLBT families.
Okay. How old are we talking about in terms of the campers? What are their ages?
Well, it's going to be grades 8 through 12, so that could be usually ages 12 through 17. That's the audience that is coming to us and telling us that this is the type of program that they're interested in.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think they need a program like this? What sort of inspired you to create this program in Michigan?
Well, again, a lot of it really was from their input, but the reason that I think it's very important for them is because they're looking for places where they can be safe, where they can meet people that they can relate to and have similar interests, and they're also looking for ways to get involved politically. They're looking for ways to become leaders in their community, and they're looking for ways to just make new friends.
But isn't it true, Greg, that a lot of high schools now have chapters for gay and lesbian students? Haven't things improved? Aren't there avenues or more avenues anyway, certainly, than there were a decade ago for students to express themselves?
Well, certainly there are more avenues today than there were 10 years ago, but that doesn't mean that there can't be even more. I mean, in the city of Detroit, there are no gay-straight student alliances, and all throughout the state, there's a number of communities where these issues are not talked about, and it's not okay for youth to be in discussion about them, but that doesn't mean that the youth aren't interested in discussing them.
And what specific activities do you do for this age group that focus really on activism or developing activist leaders?
Well, really about 75% of the activities we're going to be doing are just traditional, good old-fashioned, fun camp activities. So they're going to have the opportunity to do kayaking and to do volleyball and to do water sports. When there are youth who are interested in getting involved in civic engagement, we're going to have opportunities for them to have discussions with national leaders of political issues, to talk with each other over how they've found successful avenues to create positive change, and to learn how to work with media, to learn how to talk to politicians, and just some basic steps. But the key thing is that they're going to be picking all of their own activities. There are no mandatory activities for any of the youth. So youth who are not interested in finding out about working with the media won't be forced to attend a workshop to find out. They can instead go do canoeing for the day.
I read a report about this in the Detroit News, and some of the folks quoted in that report expressed concerns about how the campers would be housed. You might not be able to house campers the way you do in traditional camps and segregate them by sex. How do you address those concerns?
We worked with a number of child psychologists, parents, and youth and asked them what they thought would work best. And what was universally response is that doing gender-neutral housing would work best for dealing with transgender issues and also just making the camp very comfortable for all the youth that are going to be there.
Mm-hmm. And this camp is taking place at a secret location in Michigan. Why is that?
The reason that we chose to keep our location exclusively to the people who are going to be attending or to the people who will be working the event is because really they're the only ones who need to know where the camp is. There's no reason for people who aren't going to be involved with the camp to know where it is. And we want to make sure that our campers' safety is our top concern.
And what kind of response so far? Do you know how many kids you're expecting at this point? And what are people saying?
Well, we've gotten overwhelmingly positive response from parents, from youth, and most surprisingly to me, from youth professionals. As far as the numbers for youth, we feel that we're on track to be at capacity, but we're certainly still taking registrations.
No negative response so far? No people threatening to protest, criticism, nothing like that?
There's been a little bit of criticism that media sources have found. We haven't had any directed at us. I would imagine that we'll start to hear something from the usual suspects who choose to attack any topic that relates to gay issues.
Mm-hmm. Greg Varnum is Triangle Foundation's Youth Initiatives Coordinator and the organizer of a summer camp in Michigan this year that will teach young people how to advocate for gay rights. Greg, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and now. Gas prices still high and the warm weather having arrived, it looks like more people are riding their bikes to work. And according to Bicycling Magazine, several American cities have gone out of their way to welcome cyclists. Among them, Portland, Oregon, Tucson, Arizona, and Seattle, Washington, all ranked among the best U.S. cities for bike riding. Boston, where Here and Now is produced, is on the other end of the spectrum. So we ask, just what makes a city bike-friendly? Steve Madden, editor of Bicycling Magazine, has some thoughts about this, and he joins us in the studio. Steve, welcome.
Hi.
So how does a city become bike-friendly?
The most important thing a city can do to become bike-friendly is to make cyclists feel safe. That's the thing we hear most from people when we ask them, why do you ride? They say, because, you know, it's good for the environment, it's good for themselves, but they feel safe doing it. Conversely, people who don't ride say that they don't feel safe. So if you go to a place like Portland, you see these beautiful, big bike lanes, lanes that are on the street that are marked that they're strictly for cyclists. And they're big and they're wide, and cars are very respectful of them.
Well, I think that would be key. The motorists would have to be respectful, and the cyclists would have to be respectful.
That's right. And there's a little bit of a chicken and the egg problem with that, too, though, is the more drivers are used to seeing cyclists, the more respectful they become of them because they're more aware of them. If you live in a place where there are not a lot of cyclists, the drivers don't tend to be thinking, oh, I've got to look out for those guys. Or, you know, they have the same rights that I do as a driver. Their vehicles, I need to respect them as well. So it's self-fulfilling. The more cyclists are on the road, the safer they are because drivers get used to seeing them.
So Portland was a biggie. It was a good city.
That's right.
What are some of the others?
Portland's great. As you mentioned, Seattle's really good. Chicago's a really good city, about 6 months out of the year. It's very flat, right. But the city of Chicago, the mayor of Chicago is a cyclist himself, and he's really taken it upon himself to make it a safe and friendly place for cyclists. It's flat, so it's easy to ride, lots of great lanes, and an absolutely amazing bike station, a place where people can lock up their bikes safely, shower, leave their wet, sweaty stuff in lockers, go walk off to work, come back at the end of the day, pick up their bikes from the secure place, and ride home.
Well, it sounds good, but for me, for instance, it wouldn't work. I live way out in the suburbs, and coming into Boston by bike would seem like a nightmare. You're from Boston, by the way, and Boston is considered one of the worst cities for biking.
You know, I grew up in Dorchester. I learned how to ride on Templeton Street and, you know, rode my first couple of thousand miles in Boston as a bike messenger for a law firm. So one of the things that makes it tough for Boston is that the streets were laid out by cows 450 years ago. So it's not exactly a straight level playing field for cyclists. We have a program at Bicycling Magazine called Bike Town, in which we go to cities and we give away 50 bikes to encourage people to start riding. And we're doing that in Boston here, and hopefully, you know, with a fleet of 50 beautiful giant bikes out there, drivers will become more used to seeing these people. The mayor was behind it. The infrastructure, he says, is not far behind. So hopefully we'll get there.
Right. But what about paths? You talked about the wonderful path in Portland, Oregon for cyclists, and motorists are respecting it. I mean, we don't have anything near that here in Boston. I imagine a lot of other cities are in the same boat.
Well, there's a difference between a path and a bike lane. A bike lane is part of, you know, the arterial surface. You know, like it's the street and there's a lane painted on the street that's specifically for bikes. A path is, you know, like a rail trail. That's
right.
Something that's separated from vehicular traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there is some controversy about what's better. You know, cyclists say, we have rights, we're vehicles, our taxes go to maintain these roads. We have every right to be there. Where some people who some would say are a little bit more realistic say, I'm not going to put my 20-pound bike up against a 2-ton vehicle. I'd rather be on the separate rec trail riding safely.
You also talked about the bike station that you saw in
right.
Chicago and why that made that such a wonderful place to bike. In terms of practicalities for bike riding, you know, you're sweaty, you're going to go to work, there aren't showers available for people, that people have longer commutes. I mean, how do you overcome some of those real practical issues?
That's a good question. I would say that if you know, for someone like you who lives in the suburbs and has a longer commute, maybe you say, look, I'm not going to do this every single day of the week. I'll make a commitment to do this a couple of days a week, and it will be part of my workout routine for the week. You'll think ahead the days that you do take public transit or drive. You'll bring extra clothes. You can bring towels. There are a lot of products now that are designed specifically for bike commuters. You know, you can kind of spritz yourself with this stuff, rub down with a towel, and you're not nearly as funky as you might be if you'd skip the shower altogether, which is something I've learned to embrace.
Maybe not your coworkers.
Well, no, I work with a bunch of other cyclists, so it's okay. I think if I were working in a bank, it might be a different story.
I'm also wondering about safety. You talk about safety in these, in some of these bike paths or lanes. In New York, I read that there were 24 fatalities of bicyclists in 2005, mm-hmm. I believe. So that's a big issue there. I mean, how do you address that to make sure that this is also something not just practical for people, but safe for people?
Yeah,
too?
That's true. I think the most noteworthy incident in New York just happened a couple of days ago, where a doctor was he was riding on a bike path on the Hudson River, and he was struck by a police tow truck that turned in front of him. The tow truck had the right of way. The cyclist ignored his red light and was struck by the tow truck. What got lost in a lot of the reporting on that is the fact that he wasn't wearing a helmet. And the single most important thing any commuter, any rider of a bicycle needs to do is to wear a helmet at all times.
See now something like that I think is an example of maybe bringing up the question that cyclists don't need licenses. Maybe they aren't even trained to know that the tow truck in that particular case had the right of way. They don't always wear helmets, so there can be many, many risks. Are there things that need to be done to make it safer overall? Rules, laws?
I think legislating it is going to be awfully difficult and not entirely practical, because, you know, it's a rite of childhood to learn how to ride, and bikes are ubiquitous. People have them. They ride them. I think a very realistic solution would be to ask people to get proper training. The League of American Bicyclists does a great job with training and certifying cyclists so that they know how to ride safely.
And because of that, so say this is a voluntary thing, if I'm a city official, a politician looking at something like this, so what benefit do I get out of more people commuting by bike?
Well, one of the things we noticed when we did our story on the best American cities for cycling is the fact that only one of these cities on the list had a reduction in emissions, and that was Portland, Oregon. The amount of effort that the city puts into it cleans up the air. So I think there's a very viable, I mean, there's a very real benefit to it, cleaner air, because you get cleaner air, the city is on the hook for fewer cases of asthma. They have to worry less off about cleaning their buses less often. I mean, it's things like that. It really does pay a benefit.
So you bike to work now, yes?
I live between my two offices. And on days when I go into New York City, I always ride my bike to the train station, tie up, take the train in to town. When I go to Pennsylvania, it's a 75-mile drive. So I do that once a year. I do that ride once a year.
You do?
Yeah, bike to work week.
75 miles?
Yes.
How long does it take you?
All day. No, it takes about 6 hours. Very hilly.
Well, thanks very much for being with us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Steve Madden is the editor of Bicycling Magazine. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Deborah Becker. Join us next time for